Good morning to everyone in the Diocese of Orange and everywhere in Southern California. You're listening to Orange County Catholic Radio on AM 1000 in Orange and San Diego counties and on AM 930 in Los Angeles County. We're coming to you through the good offices of Immaculate Heart Radio today from our studios on the campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove, where Catholic faith is crystal clear. I'm Rick Howick of St. Joseph Radio, and today we're going to be talking about a number of different issues. And the way I want to frame that is that we've had several guests that have come on and we've talked about a number of things, and we've had several things that have happened over the last couple of weeks that I thought it would be a good idea for us to just plumb a little bit. So with that in mind, let's get right into it. Today I was reading through some material that came in regarding some of the stuff that's happening, some of the horrible things that have been happening in the Middle East, but throughout the world, in regard to Muslim violence on Muslims, on violence in the world toward Christians. And I was seeing that in Rome, the Trevi Fountain, which is this absolutely spectacular fountain that was done there at the Vatican, is going to run red on April 29th. And it's going to run red in honor of Christian martyrs throughout the world who have lived and who have died at the hands of militant Islam. And it's raised a number of concerns by a lot of people, because in Europe, of course, we had what happened in Brussels and then what happened just before that in Paris with the horrible massacres that took place. Yet you've got a number of people that are saying all this is going to do is to underscore the prejudice that's out there. So on the AP, they put out a story from Dudley, Massachusetts, and I'll read you a small snippet of that. Leaders of a local mosque hope to build a final resting place for about 500 Muslim families, but the neighbors fear that the burial practices could contaminate the groundwater because Muslims traditionally do not embalm their bodies or bury their dead without coffins. They also cite concerns about noise and vandalism and increased traffic on the narrow road. In short, this is a thinly veiled bigotry. And yet, if we're looking at this, because we have a number of instances that have taken place where we see this kind of thing happen. I know that there is a mosque that is going up in the Inland Empire in the Marietta area, and it faced huge obstacles from neighbors in order to try to get it built. One of the issues that comes to mind from all of this is the two messages that are being put out there by different people. We've got one group of people that are talking about banning Muslims from entry into the United States, and genuinely afraid because they've seen the violence that's happened in Paris. It only took a few Muslim militants to do this. And they saw what happened in San Bernardino. It only took two Muslim militants to do that. And they're afraid. And then you have another group that talks about Islam as being a religion of peace, and that we really can't paint Islam in the way that we've been painting them. In fact, there have been a couple of articles that have come out that I thought were absolutely fantastic on dealing with this issue, but they come from two different perspectives. One of them talks about standing with the persecuted, and that was done by Rob Schwarzenwalder. And it was talking about how we need to stand with those who are being persecuted across the Middle East. And it doesn't take so much of a stand against Islam, but it takes a stand against Boko Haram and ISIS in the Middle East. And he allows there to be a differentiation between Islam itself and ISIS. Yet, on the other hand, another article came out a few weeks before that by Russell Shaw, who talked in detail about the clash of civilizations that's here really has more to do with secularism than it does with the Islamic religion itself. And here's what I mean by that. In Islam, you have teachings that are called surahs that are arranged in the Quran that come in the order of length versus instead of what you would think that they come in the order of when they were written. And when you read the Quran, you have a number of different passages that talk about the spread of Islam through peace. And a lot of people will seize on those verses, those surahs, and try to make the case that this is a religion of peace because it talks about reasoning people and the idea that you're going to show that Islam is the better religion to come through. Yet, as Muhammad continued to try to bring Islam to the communities that he was in, he unfortunately encountered a great deal of resistance. And as he went through his later life, a number of the surahs that came out really started talking about force and the concept of someone can be forced to embrace Islam against their will. And that, in fact, there became a huge debate about how one becomes a Muslim. Does one become a Muslim through an act of faith where one believes in Islam and therefore becomes a Muslim? Or does one become a Muslim because they're forced to? And if they're forced to, does that make a real Muslim? From the traditional Islamic perspective, in light of those later surahs, the answer is both. And that, in fact, was what created a huge controversy a few years back when Pope Benedict gave a speech in Regensburg, Germany, and he started talking about the idea that Islam, while it has aspects of reasoning in it, is nevertheless still founded on an act of the will. And he contrasted that with Christianity, where in Christianity, we build a relationship with an encounter with God, and God is a loving father. And Jesus, as his son, is our loving brother. And our encounter with Christ is one of deep and utter love for him because he first loved us. It's therefore relational. Whereas in Islam, it's about God being master and has created us to serve him. And that is by an act of the will, far beyond an act of reasoning. Now, that, of course, exploded right afterwards when Pope Benedict gave that speech in Regensburg, but it ignited a great deal of discussion. And the reality is that there really is this dichotomy, these two ways of looking at how one becomes a Muslim in Islam. And to this very day, we're still dealing with that. In the United States, there are many, many Muslims who embrace that concept of Islam being a religion of peace. And these are people who practice their faith as one that orders their life, organizes their life, allows them to have a faith that brings them to a higher degree of embrace of something beyond themselves. And it makes them better people. But yet it also must be recognized that in Muslim countries throughout the world where we have a strict Muslim government, those governments run what can only be described most often as an oppressive regime. So in Saudi Arabia, women do not have equal rights. Women can't even drive. You're not allowed to go anywhere as a woman without having a male from the household with you as a minder. Christianity cannot be freely practiced in many of these Muslim countries. And in fact, what we're seeing in ISIS today isn't all that dissimilar from what we saw in aspects of Islam for thousands of years. One of the things that I do is to talk at different churches and parishes about usually themes in Christian history. My background is that of a Christian historian primarily. And I was talking about a week ago about the Middle Ages, and we were discussing what actually forged the identity of Europe during the Middle Ages. So somewhere a little before 500, we have the fall of Rome in the West, which was really a sudden thing, but adapted to gradually. And in the West, essentially, the office of the Pope and the bishops that were in the countryside were what held things together for quite some time. But when the Muslims came on the scene in the 600s, we had all of North Africa, which used to be really a part of what you would call the Roman Empire, was taken over very quickly. And then the surge went up into Spain, and they took over most of the Iberian Peninsula, which a lot of people don't remember, but they held for about 700 years, up until the 1490s, when you had Isabel and Ferdinand chase the rest of them out. Until then, you still had Muslims there, and in fact, it wasn't until the Battle of Tours in the 800s, or in the 700s, when Charles Martel was able to stop the Muslim invasion, and then they had to go back beyond the Pyrenees and stayed in the Pyrenees. It was traumatic, and it was a way to solidify the identity of Europe as we are Christian, we are not Muslim. On the eastern side of Europe, you had the Byzantine Empire being pressed upon by the Muslims, who gradually take over all of what is modern-day Turkey, which used to be that really was the original birthplace of most of Christianity. Jerusalem, of course, is where Jesus was born, but the very first churches that Paul settled were those churches in what we call Asia, which is Turkey. And then, of course, they continued moving on up. They took over Constantinople. They were stopped in the 1400s right outside of Vienna. So from both ends, you have for hundreds of years the identity in Europe that we're confronting an opposition force that is not peaceful. Now, let's fast forward for a little bit. Modern Muslim theology, especially as experienced in the United States, is one that reaches out and seeks to have understanding with other faiths. I have been part of Muslim Christian dialogues in the past. I'm aware and know of a great deal of Muslim communities that are integrated fully into the life of the United States and see a synchronization between their understanding of Islam and how it's practiced and the American dream, so to speak. But what we can't separate ourselves from is the reality that there is no unity within Islam. We not only have two very distinct versions of Islam between the Sunnis and the Shiite, and it cannot be denied that we have encountered Islam recently in ways that have been jarring and reminds us that they're in their own conflict and they're coming to their own almost reformation, a civil war amongst themselves. And it's no longer just between Sunnis and Shias. It's between those who seek a religion of peace and those who seek to take over the world the way that was envisioned 800 years ago. When we come back, we'll be talking a little bit more about a different topic. I want to talk a little bit about the bathroom bill. And you're listening to Orange County Catholic Radio. I'm Rick Howick, your host, and we'll be right back. And we're back on Orange County Catholic Radio. And we've been talking today a little bit about the problems that we have in relating to Islam. And I was talking a little bit during the break to my producer, Jim, and he had a couple of interesting takes on this, too. And so I'm going to throw it to him in just a moment. But one of the things that I think I need to kind of summarize on that, I'm seeing, and this is as someone who's taking a look at it from a historical perspective, I'm seeing very similar strands in Islam right now as to what we endured 500 years ago in our own Reformation, where we had two very different cultures trying to stay together and yet really couldn't. And the pain of that coming into the modern age, really, the pain of those Reformations was absolutely horrible for us. We had wars over it, and it's still painful to this day. Our producer, Jim, had a couple of comments, though. You've worked with other people in other organizations that deal a lot with the refugees, and you had a different take on this.
Yeah, I do, Rick. You know, I'm very blessed to work kind of behind the scenes here at Orange County Catholic Radio, producing much of the shows, and I occasionally get to pop in every now and then. But there is a ministry that I work with that runs on Christian radio. It really is a fabulous ministry. And the gentleman who's the head of this ministry has such a heart for the refugees and the tremendous crisis that's taking place right now, which is really mind-boggling when you think about all the people who've been really forced to flee from their homes. And in many cases, these are professional people. These are people who had property, professional people, doctors and school teachers, who were forced to flee from their homes for the most part because of they would not convert to the Muslim faith, or they weren't of the proper Muslim sect, I suppose you could say. So when I think about the crisis going on right now with just the issues of the fear that we have of terrorism and whatnot, more and more, I think my heart has been more tenderized just from the standpoint of thinking of the refugees and what they're going through and what exactly would Jesus do in this situation. Not that we are here in America going to be completely opening our doors. I know that's a very tricky situation, but I think the Jim, and my name is Jim, the Jim from 10, 15, 20 years ago, I think I would have had a certain attitude, more of hard line, we need to protect ourselves sort of attitude. But nowadays I think to myself, you know, indeed, what would Jesus do in this situation with so many people really literally homeless? What are we called to do as Catholic Christians? You know, really, where is our heart?
You know, you're hitting on something, too, that's got a two-edged sword. And the people of Europe, for example, right now, they're on the front line of that. So literally coming across in boats are thousands and thousands and thousands of these refugees who are very different from the majority of Europeans. not so much because they're Muslim, but because they're not either Christian or secular, because the majority religion right now in Europe is secular. It's secularism.
Right.
And it's not really Christianity anymore. But there's a xenophobia that can take place there. And you add to that some of the incidents that, of course, have taken place. The terror cell that grew up in Brussels that inflicted such horror on Paris and on Brussels. Some of the incidents that have taken place during revelries in Germany where women have been assaulted. Mm-hmm. And the people that were involved in the assaulting were of Muslim descent. And so I can see where we've got people that are genuinely torn, who want to do the right thing. So they watch Pope Francis go and bring home to the Vatican refugees to symbolize this is what we should do. This is what Jesus would do. But I also find it hard to thoroughly condemn those who are afraid, because I think there's a genuine fear, not of the unknown anymore, though that's not helping, but a genuine fear of these are people, some of whom want to kill us, and we don't know which ones they are. I mean, it's a little bit different than having people coming over from, say, Central America, who may be speaking a different language, so they're different from the majority of people in the United States. But nevertheless, we're not primarily afraid that they're out to kill us. And so there might be people that are uncomfortable because it's a different culture, but they're not uncomfortable because they think they're going to die. And I know of people who are expressing exactly what you expressed, this feeling that what would Jesus do, that I must do, regardless of the consequences, and yet they also feel anxiety, but what happens if someone attacks my school or someone attacks my Christmas party, like what happened in San Bernardino? I'm also looking at another aspect of this, and this is where I was going to jump into. I think there's a number of people where we're getting into a perfect storm of issues. I think it's one of the reasons why in this particular political season, the two most outside candidates are the ones who have generated the most response. They may not be the front runners, like Bernie Sanders is not the front runner right now in the Democratic Party, but he certainly has surprised a number of people with his strength. And Donald Trump, who is the front runner in the Republican Party, has also surprised certainly the party insiders with his strength. And what I think they're both pulling on is the idea that the people are looking at so much change in their society that they just want to have some normalcy. So we now have, in the last 10 years, huge changes that have taken place in our culture. We no longer have the respect for marriage between a man and a woman, which we Catholics understand to be the only marriage that is possible. We have, in our secular society, the formal recognition and the forcing of people to recognize that people who are of the same who have the same sex are, quote, married, unquote, when they claim they're married. And now we've got this being put forward that if you feel that you identify as a certain gender and you're not biologically of that gender, you've got the biological equipment of a man and yet you think you're a woman, if that's how you identify, then you can go into whatever bathroom you choose to. And it's being enforced with boycotts. And we've got, for example, in North Carolina, the bathroom bill that they passed in there is being boycotted by the state of New York because the state of New York feels that it's discriminatory to limit bathroom usage to people who are biologically of one gender. Now we've got a boycott on Target that's being talked about. I know on this particular radio station, Patrick Madrid has been really drumming up support for the Target boycott. And it's interesting because what Target has basically done, they've declared that their stores will allow anyone who identifies as whatever gender to use whatever restroom they want to. And it's outraged people because he's actually going at it from the perspective, well, this is primarily going to benefit perverted men who want to go ogle women and little girls. And it's not going to take care of the few people in our society who genuinely have a transgendered viewpoint. Therefore, I want to safeguard my children and I want to safeguard my wife and my sisters. Therefore, we should not allow this. You should only go to the bathrooms that you are genetically and biologically suited for. I take it from a different perspective. And I was reading Dr. Keith Ablow's piece from April 22nd, where he was saying there's another point here. The reason why this stuff is being forced on us, whether it is bakers who have to bake a cake for a gay wedding, or you have to allow anyone to go into the bathroom, it's being forced on us because there is an agenda that will have people be allowed to be whatever they think they want to be. It is the legalization of subjective morality. You are what you think. If I feel something, it must be good. It must be okay. And that's in direct conflict with everything we've understood about morality from a Catholic perspective. I don't know how what your feelings are on this, Jim, but I know that there are a number of people who kind of think, well, what's the big deal? Charles Krauthammer came out and basically said, this seems to be, I'm going to quote him wrong, but this is a solution in search of an issue. Do we really have an epidemic of transgender people who are feeling like they can't use the bathroom? Let them use the bathroom. Who really cares? But I think there is the secondary thing that Dr. Ablow was referring to, and it's this idea that if we can force you to open the bathroom doors, so to speak, then you're acknowledging that what has scientific basis or is objectively true is not the basis for our morality anymore. If you want to think that abortion's okay, it's okay. If you want to think that adultery is okay, it's okay. We can't even call it adultery. You follow what I'm saying with that?
This obviously is a major, major hot button issue right now. It is top of mind for so many people. And I think what I'm finding here, Rick, I don't know if you're seeing this, but it seems to be bringing people together, kind of a strange bedfellows sort of thing, where there are people who otherwise wouldn't be maybe necessarily for a conservative point of view on a number of social issues, who also think that what's going on with this whole Target, the bathroom thing, is out of line. So it's interesting. It's going to be very interesting to follow this story to see exactly what happens, because these boycotts don't typically really work per se.
But. No, they generally don't, but they do bring attention to the idea that, no, we didn't go down without a fight on this. And it may be only symbolic, but that's what most fights are about anyway. So to me, it's about the left basically saying that we can force you and you're going to capitulate. Mm-hmm. Just like the nuns, when they were told that they must provide access to basically abortions, and they fought back. We don't have the decision yet, but whether they win, lose, or draw, and they could draw on this one, they win, lose, or draw, they still were able to say, no, this is wrong. And I think we need to stand up and say, this is wrong. So when we come back, I want to go ahead and shift gears just a little bit, but it kind of falls in line with what we've been talking about and bring up a little bit. There was a question and answer session that was done that asked the interesting question that's usually been viewed as just a joke. Is the Pope Catholic? But the question, of course, was a real question. So you're listening to Orange County Catholic Radio. I'm Rick Howick, your host. And when we come back, we'll take on that issue.
Faustina, messenger of divine worship, comes to the Fried Theater on the Christ Cathedral campus beginning on August the 12th. This live, multimedia drama, performed by Maria Vargo and directed by Leonardo DeFilippis, is an amazing look into the spiritual life and strength of faith of St. Faustina. For tickets and more information, visit ChristCathedralCalifornia.org. That's ChristCathedralCalifornia.org.
And we're back high atop the Tower of Hope here at Christ Cathedral, where Catholic faith is crystal clear. Although today, Jim, we're kind of hopeful that it really is. We're talking today about some cleanup issues, some issues that are happening within our society. We were talking a little bit about the angst that people have been feeling about Islam and what it means, and especially in light of what essentially amounts to their own civil war, and it has spilled over into our society. When I say our, meaning primarily a non-Muslim society. And then we talked a little bit about this division we have between those who are of a viewpoint that morality really is what you want it to be, subjective morality, and the traditional Catholic position that no, morality is objective. Certain things are either right or wrong. How culpable you are might depend on certain subjective things, but killing a baby is always wrong to do. You might have your reasons for doing it, and maybe some of those might reduce some of your culpability, perhaps. But from a Catholic perspective, it's always wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's really the difference. And it's kind of funny because, and this is where I want to go with this next section, when we were dealing with the interim between the first synod on the family a year and a half ago, roughly, and the second synod on the family, and we had a number of people talking then about what's going to happen. Then it unfolded, and we had the second synod. It almost looked like people were setting it up to be, there was rumor that was being set up to have a new agenda in order to change how the Catholic Church goes about its morality. And that got shot down. There were a number of people from the Vatican who came out right away and said, no, that's not true. And then there was a great deal of discussion and debate. And of course, the Casper initiative that was put out there, which really isn't new. It was actually shot down, or a version of it was shot down in the 1960s at the First Vatican Council. And we went with a morality that said certain things are objectively right or objectively wrong. And it doesn't change. Whereas for Cardinal Casper out of Germany, he talks about the changing of society and times necessitates a change in how we see our morality. Essentially, God does change. And there was a great deal of fear and angst that I had amongst friends of mine who are a little more on the conservative side in Catholic faith. And it was almost as if they were worried that Pope Francis was going to somehow abandon the faith. And in fact, I was mentioning before we went off that there was a gathering of people discussing just this at the Fordham University panel called Is the Pope Catholic? And it was a genuine discussion, including some very famous people talking about that very topic. Has the Pope gone off the rails? And the answer, of course, despite what some of the people in there were saying, including Ross Duhat, who works with the New York Times but is a conservative commentarist from the New York Times, he more or less thinks that the Pope kind of has, and there's no real evidence for that. In fact, it's kind of funny. The evidence is really on the other side. Hmm. And what I saw when I read through, and I'll say it wrong because I don't do Latin. I do Greek and Hebrew, but not the Latin. Amoris Laetitia, the new writing that Pope Francis came out with, the apostolic exhortation, that he founds again the basis of marriage on the indissolubility act of God. It makes it objectively a sacrament and it's indissoluble. And he reaffirms that. And there's no evidence to indicate he was ever in danger of not reaffirming that. Mm-hmm. But what you hear as you read through that document into roughly section 6 and section 8 is almost a tortured pontiff who does see the objective reality of what should be, but as he titles chapter 8 as what do we do with those who are weak, we have the reality that people don't always live up to this, and now they're in pain. Can we do something? What can we do to minister to their pain? And that is what I believe those two synods were all about, Jim. Hmm. That those synods were not so much about, do we change our theology? Though he allowed that question to come up, and it was effectively shot down. We can't change our objective theology. But can we change our pastoral care so that we take care of our suffering people differently? And it's funny because I remember writing some people shortly before this document came out when people were speculating, and there was almost damage control going on the right side of the spectrum, saying what if the Pope does say something? Well, he's not infallible when he's talking this way. And no, he was never in danger of that, and there's a reason for that. And this is something that is a faith statement, and it's something that I genuinely believe. But the bottom line for me is I don't believe that the Pope can possibly come out on an object of faith and morals that is going to be heretical. What's your thought on this, Jim?
You know, Rick, I'm sure you've heard this before a multitude of times. I think it's good for us to wrestle with these things. I think it's good for us to have a sort of a healthy tension over different things because it shows that we're not automatrons, you know, we're not robots. And I can recall hearing a sermon where I thought, wow, that really does make a lot of sense, where we may have a very firmly held belief on one side, but when we try to look at the other side where someone else is coming from, we try to put ourselves in their shoes. And somehow or another, that can bring us to a healthy sort of tension and just enable us to maybe open up our hearts a little bit more than we had in the past. I think that's a healthy place to be. And I may not have said a whole heck of a lot there, but that's
no. It's
kind of where I'm coming from. As I get older, that's kind of where I come from. You
know? Well, and I think that's where the whole theme has been of this broadcast today, when we were talking about the genuine angst that we have as good, solid Christians who want to open our hearts to the strangers that are coming from war-torn Middle East, and yet we're scared to death that we're going to invite evil into our own country.
A couple of bad apples.
And we are struggling with what it is to be in a society that is trying to change radically its understanding of morality away from a Christian-based morality, which is objective, to a secular-based morality, which is subjective. And the pain of that has been the Little Sisters of the Poor having to pay for abortion coverage, and that the bakers are going to be sued if they don't supply the wedding cake to a wedding that they don't believe is actually moral. So now when we're looking at the Pope, you know, I look at it from the perspective, I think it was important, as you pointed out, for our pontiff to ask us to struggle with this, even if it was just a struggle. Do you realize that we have people who are genuinely hurting over this, and the pain is real, and it's more than you think it is? And even though he came out with a document that in the end really affirmed so much, and I know there are some people out there who have said, no, it's too confusing. No, go back and reread. He asked us to read it carefully. Go back and reread. The document is clear, but it does raise some questions about what can we do pastorally. But I go back, my faith was predicated, my conversion to the Catholic Church was predicated on the idea that we would have infallibility in the church. And I looked at this historically. And, you know, as I was saying, I had just done, not a couple days ago, I was teaching on the Middle East, and I was reviewing some of the notes that I had there. The popes, for example, from the 800s and the 900s and the first half of the 11th century, the 1000s, were absolutely abominable morally. Hmm. You had Italian warring families, essentially like the mafia, knocking off other popes to get their people on the throne. Hmm. You had popes that were involved in human sexual morality that we really can't talk about on the air. We had such horrible popes morally in that period. We had several. And I remember as a Protestant, I was kind of licking my chops and getting ready. Okay, where there's smoke, there's fire. But I noticed something. The more that I looked into these people, I noticed two big things. One, these people, these popes, did not talk about theology, which means that whether this was coincidental because they weren't concerned about it, they were more concerned about their sensuality, or it was the intervention of the Holy Spirit, for all of their peccadilloes, they didn't do anything to compromise the theology of the church. Hmm. And the second thing that I noticed was that when we have trauma in the church, God always uses that trauma to purge the church and make it stronger. Hmm. So I'll just give you the example. I just said that 800s, 900s, first part of the 11th century, the 1000s, was a very difficult time period for a lot of pontiffs. We had pontiffs that, on average, were reigning about 2 years at different times in there. And it was a horrible time. And yet, in 1049, you have Leo IX come in, and he is deeply influenced by the reforms that were taking place 100 years earlier in Cluny, at the monastery there, where the Benedictine order had been revamped, and they were now literally practicing it. And he brought in a very strong reform of the church at that time, which eventually, he was helped by a guy named Hildebrand, who 20 years later becomes Pope Gregory VII, and we name those reforms after him, the Gregorian reforms. And that's just one example. When we had the explosions of the Reformation, we had the Counter-Reformation, where we re-examined and became stronger because of it. Hmm. If you go back to the earliest church, when we had persecutions and pogroms that wiped out whole sets of people, we had people joining the church in droves. As Tertullian said, right around the year 200, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. So I'm looking at all of these issues today, and that's why I wanted to do a little bit of kind of issue talking today. Because what I'm seeing, that a lot of our issues that we're dealing with today are really all connected, and we as Catholics need to kind of just stay calm and keep looking forward. Christ is in the church and is bigger than all of us. Whether that is from those we open our arms to who are refugees, or those who are coming to us in irregular marriages, we really do need to be about, how can I help heal you? How can I bring Christ to you? When we come back, we're going to shift gears dramatically, and we've got online Chad Berlingeri. And Chad is going to talk to us about an upcoming event that's taking place on Friday, May 6th, here on campus, that you won't want to miss. This is Rick Howick from Orange County Catholic Radio, and we'll be right back.
The passing of a loved one is a difficult and often sorrowful step in life's journey. The helpful and supportive staff at the Cathedral Memorial Garden Cemetery, located on the 34-acre iconic Christ Cathedral campus, are here to assist you and your family through this transition, offering a central location, serene garden-like grounds, majestic fountains, and a dramatic statuary, all set within the beautiful Christ Cathedral campus. For more information, please visit memorialgardens.christcathedralcalifornia.org or contact 714-489-6102. Located on the beautiful Christ Cathedral campus in Garden Grove, Christ Cathedral Academy is a preschool through 8th grade private Catholic school offering an excellent and well-rounded education. Program features include a dynamic choral program, Meet the Masters arts program, and a full orchestra ensemble. Additionally, the Academy offers a one-to-one technology program, integrating iPads, smart boards, and digital curriculum into every classroom. At Christ Cathedral Academy, our mission is to form leaders who share the rewards of religious and academic study so that they may praise God, bless our world, and preach the truth. We are now enrolling students for the next academic year. Call to schedule a tour and witness the amazing opportunities your child could be receiving at Christ Cathedral Academy. Call to schedule a tour, 714-663-2330, or visit christcathedral.academy.
And we're back. Joining me today is Chad Berlingeri. Chad, did I say your name correctly?
Perfect. Thanks, Rick.
And Chad is the CEO of the Cathedral Productions here.
That's correct.
Describe exactly what your title is, and then tell us a little bit about why you're here, because we've got something very special coming up.
Excellent. Well, yeah, I'm the executive producer and CEO of Cathedral Productions, and I produce a concert series that takes place here at the Christ Cathedral. This next concert, which is Friday, May 6th at 8 p.m. in the Arboretum, is the last show that's in the series. We did Evening of Elegance in November, of course, The Messiah at Christmas, Love Songs for Valentine's Day, and finally we have Rhapsody in Blue and Carmina Burana coming to the Arboretum.
Oh, I love Rhapsody in Blue. I think most of us, when we see Rhapsody in Blue, though, we kind of think a little bit about United Airlines and their whole commercial.
Exactly. That's one of the themes that you've heard. That's kind of where we're at getting this concert series started. I'm producing events that are I try to make them as accessible as possible to the common ear so that people will say, hey, I've heard that before on TV.
So tell us a little bit about what has gone before as part of this concert series. What set this up?
Well, you see, last year I've been adding a production every year. So this is the end of year three. Last year we added the Verdi Requiem that we did in tribute to the passing of Dr. Schuller. That was a very special event. And that was a huge production. That was one of the largest things I'd done at the time, with a 65-piece orchestra and 200 in the choir. This piece coming is actually going to be, again, the largest thing I've ever produced before.
So larger yet.
Even bigger, yeah. So, you know, when you're at the cathedral, you have to go big. So we've got 200 adults in the choir with a 50-piece children's chorus. There are it's 66 in the orchestra with double piano. I'm actually shipping in a 9-foot Steinway that's coming in for our soloist, Grace Fong from Chapman University. So there'll be two grand pianos on stage. And with soloists and conductor, we're expecting 325 performers on the altar of the Arboretum.
Wow. I've only been able to play a 9-foot Steinway grand once before they threw me out. But anyway.
Exactly. That's great.
It sounds wonderful. And it sounds
Thank
like
you.
the entire production is going to be absolutely stunning and fantastic. What can you tell me about what they're going to hear?
Sure. Well, it's really a double build concert, which consists of the cool jazz of the Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue and the passion in Orff's Carmina Burana, which leads us to the emotions of what I considered Fire and Ice, which you can see in my graphics, combining to create, again, an immediacy and an accessibility not found in many works combined. This season's Bishop's Pick, Bishop Band really, really enjoys Gershwin. The Rhapsody, of course, is regarded to be one of the most important American musical works of the 20th century, whereas in Carmina Burana, we can really hear the monks in the monasteries using elements of Gregorian chant.
So if we're interested in this kind of music, we would like to attend, do you have any examples that you could help us play that we could actually hear a little bit of sampling?
Sure. So we're going to open the concert with Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. There's two very familiar themes that you'll recognize. And of course, the first half is the more of the jazzy aspect of the Gershwin when we open with clarinet and trumpet solos. And I think you'll probably recognize the opening theme. The second half of the Gershwin, the theme changes, and you might recognize that from TV commercials of a certain airline company that features that in their ad campaign as well.
So that was fantastic. But I understand that that's only one half of your Fire and Ice theme production.
That's right. Again, it's a double build concert. So after the Rhapsody, we go into intermission, and I actually have to change the deck of the performance. So the piano goes out over because Carmina is double pianoed. And again, 66 in the orchestra. The choir comes up of 200, the kids' chorus of 50. And then we go into Karl Orff's Carmina Burana, really known for its major themes, the O Fortuna. You've probably heard in every Nike commercial or every football ad, probably on TV as well. Again, very recognizable and accessible. And that one sounds like this.
So if we're interested in attending your concert, and of course everyone that is listening in Southern California is going to be interested in this, what does it cost? What do you need to do? Where should they go? Give us some information, Chad.
Excellent. So general admission for this concert is $35, and that's the back half of the Arboretum. It's 1,000 seats. Orchestra seating, which is considered the front half of the Arboretum, is $50. There's also VIP seating available in the first and second rows, and fortunately enough, those tend to sell out first. Now, we're running a special promotional right now, promo of the code of Carmina2016. So if you go online at cathedralproductions.com,
that's cathedralproductions.com,
and type in Carmina 2016, you can save 20% on your tickets in the general admission and orchestra seating. Students and religious are just $20.
Okay, so that is a really good deal. So all of you who are religious, please come on in and you'll be able to get quite a bit of a discount. again, if they are interested, they're going to go to cathedralproductions.com.
Yep. Or you can call me at 714-883-7987.
That number again was?
714-883-7987.
Now, this was in a long series. This is the last one for the season?
It's a four-show series, and we start in November, December, February, and May. I have to kind of spread them out around the church's availability, of course, you know, with Christmas and Easter and all the things that this church has become. A huge beacon for religious activity under the guidance of Bishop Vann in a very, very short period of time.
And he's going to be there to talk about George Gershwin.
He is. He is a huge Gershwin fan, and he's going to give us a pre-show lecture on the composer himself.
I'm looking forward to it. This sounds like a fantastic opportunity for our listening audience to come in. Of course, the grounds here are absolutely beautiful and stunning, and I understand the building you're talking about has some fantastic acoustics.
It's great with all the glass and stainless that they redid the building with. The acoustics are quite fantastic.
So it actually comes across as a unique listening experience, something that really would be hard to duplicate anywhere else.
With the 325 artists that are going to be on the altar, it is going to be an awe-inspiring sound.
I am thrilled, and I'm looking forward to it. Chad, I want to thank you very much for coming in and for talking with us a little bit about this. And again, if they want to have that information, they can either call you at
714-883-7987.
Or they can go online to
cathedralproductions.com.
We are looking forward to going, and I hope that all of our listening audience is going to be looking forward to going as well. Chad, so tell us a little bit about the people who are going to be performing.
Sure. So we have a featured world-renowned pianist, Miss Grace Fong, joining us from Chapman University, where she chairs the piano faculty. A longtime friend of mine, soprano Maria Cristina Navarro, comes to us from the Pacific Chorale. Tenor Benjamin Brecker is from the New York City Opera. We'll be singing The Roasted Swan in the Carmina Burana, a very, very famous piece. And baritone soloist Joseph Latanzi is coming from Cincinnati Opera, and he will be making his cathedral debut with us as well, recently performing the piece with the Chicago Symphony. Conducting both works, again, longtime and dear friend, Maestro Valery Rivkin, Russian conductor, comes to us from the Merlo program in San Francisco, and he's also with Santa Barbara Opera and Temple University, and my longtime mentor and chorus master of Opera Pacific, Arizona Opera, and Cincinnati Opera, Maestro Henry Venanzi will be returning to Orange County to join us and prepare the choirs that will be in the performance.
Once again, Chad, I want to thank you for all this information that's come to us about this fantastic event. And I'm looking forward to going. I'm sure that all our listening audience is going to be looking forward to going. And you've been listening to Orange County Catholic Radio. I'm Rick Howick, your host. And we have been coming to you high atop the Tower of Hope here on the beautiful campus in Garden Grove of Christ Cathedral. And we will see you again next week.
The Christ Cathedral Drama Series is excited to announce our 2016-17 season. After an incredible inaugural year that welcomed more than 5,000 people to the Freed Theater at Christ Cathedral, a new show has been added in honor of our Holy Father Francis, a live drama depicting the life and ministry of St. Francis of Assisi has been added to the upcoming 2016-17 season. We are also offering a discounted season pass at 25% off. For information on individual performances or to purchase tickets for the season, please visit us at ChristCathedralCalifornia.org or call 714-282-3045. Once again, that website is ChristCathedralCalifornia.org or call us at 714-282-3045. 714-282-3045.